ॐ पार्थाय प्रतिबोधिदां भगवता नारायणेन स्वयं व्यासेन ग्रथिदां पुराणमुनिना मध्ये महाभारतम् अद्वैतामृतवर्षिणीं भगवतीं अष्टादशाध्यायिनीं अम्ब त्वामनुसन्दधामि भगवद्गीते भवद्वेषिणीम्। यं ब्रह्मा वरुणेन्द्ररुद्रमरुदस्तुन्यन्ति दिव्यैस्तवैः वेदैः साङ्गपदक्रमोपनिषदैः गायन्ति यं सामगाः ध्यानावस्थिततद्गतेन मनसा पश्यन्ति यं योगिनो यस्यान्तं न विदुःसुरासुरगणाः देवाय तस्मै नमः। So we will continue our discussion on the second chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, the 46th and the 47th verse together. We are discussing in the last session, we will continue that discussion. So the 46th verse, I already gave a brief exposition of some of these ideas. The verse is, Yavan artha udapani sarvadas samplutodagi tavan sarveshu vedeshu brahmanasya vijanataka. This verse is very important for one reason, you know. You must have heard of the word Brahmin in the ancient Vedic tradition. You find this repeated in the Buddhist tradition also. Buddha also calls a spiritually enlightened person by the name Brahmin. It is not the name of a caste. It is not the name of a specially privileged group of people who alone are allowed to do worship in a temple. It is not a kind of classification of society into different groups. A Brahmin or a Brahmana, as the Sanskrit word is properly pronounced, means a spiritually enlightened person. I already quoted from one important verse from the most popular Buddhist text. It is called Dhammapada, which has been translated into all world languages. Innumerable translations are available. Originally, it is in Pali language, which is a primitive form of Sanskrit. In that book, Buddha gives a series of definitions, a list of the fundamental characteristics of a person of spiritual awareness. So one important characteristic of a person who could be called a Brahmin or Brahmana is a spiritually enlightened person. One should not mistake this word with the title of Emerson's four verses poem, you know, Brahma, that is Brahma, that actually signifies, is Brahman is the right word, but frequently misspelled in many of the translations. It implies the fundamental spiritual reality, the divine reality, the presence of God, present in everything. It is all pervading, it is immanent, it is present in all of us. It is one divine reality. That's the true meaning of the word Brahman, which is actually the title, ought to be the title of Emerson's well-known poem. Here the word is Brahmana. Frequently it is spelled as Brahmin, it is called. Very often it is, if you read, if you just go to the dictionary or an encyclopedia and find an explanation, description of the word Brahmin, you find it is one of the four castes of Hindu society. It is maybe the highest caste, as they will call it. It is one of the four groups of Hindu society. But that is not the real meaning of the word Brahmana according to this book, I mean Bhagavad Gita. So what is, who is a Brahmin? Yavan artha udabane sarvada sampludotake tavan sarveshu vedeshu brahmanasya vijanataka. A Brahmin who is naturally a man of spiritual, a man or woman of spiritual awareness. How does he live? How does he look at the world? And how does he interact with the rest of human beings? So, there is a very interesting simile and illustration, an elaborate metaphor involved in this particular poem. The illustration is this. Now, in dry season, when there is not enough rain, you may need a well or a pond to collect water for drinking or maybe for bathing or a river. You go to a well and you draw water for drinking. You may go to a river to take a bath. You may go to maybe a pond also to take a bath. So you can't just take a bath in the well and drink water from the pond or river. You don't do that. You use the well for water for drinking and a river for bathing, etc. Maybe for swimming. You can't swim in a well, obviously. Now, there is this difference there. Now, suppose there is a huge flood, a spread of water. Then you find this water everywhere. You don't see the river, you don't see the well, you don't see the pond, and you don't see a stream, all flooded with water. Water everywhere. So what do you do? Suppose you want drinking water, and well, think of, let's say, 5000 BC, or maybe 3000 BC as the period of the Bhagavad Gita, 5000 years back. They didn't have boiled water, maybe bottled water, anything. So they had to drink water from the same water, the spread of water, the huge flood. All the differentiations vanished. You can't see where is a river. You can't see where is a pond. You can't see where is the well. So wherever you go, you can drink that water. You may take the take bath in that water. Now, a spiritually enlightened person, when he goes beyond the rituals, beyond the mechanical practices, he sees God everywhere. So when God becomes a reality in your real life, then you don't think, well, I'm thinking of God because I'm inside a temple or a church. I should not think of God because I'm in the office. You should be able to think of God in the office place, in the university, in the hospital where you are employed, and also inside a church or a temple. So all the lines of demarcations, differentiations disappear. Just as the lines of demarcations disappear completely when there is a flood, because water everywhere. So a spiritually enlightened person, for him there is no differentiation between the secular and the spiritual. Even the secular activities he do in a spiritual way. So the secular merges with the spiritual. There are people who do spiritual things in a secular way. That's a tragedy of modern religious practices. So an ideal spiritual person should do the secular activities in the spiritual way. Spirituality should not merge in the secular. The secular should merge in the spiritual. So all these differentiations vanish. That's why an ideal devotee of God in any religion, in any tradition, or maybe an enlightened person who may not even believe in any religion or God, an enlightened person, for him, there is no secular spiritual equation or differentiations. So that's why in the Bhagavata Purana, the ideal devotee of God, who has reached a mystical level of spiritual awareness, is described as, that means, a person who sees God everywhere and sees everything in God. Sarva bhudeshu yappasyet bhagavat bhavam atmanaha bhudani bhagavati atmani esha bhagavatottamaha. Bhagavatottama means the highest, the most highly evolved spiritual person, a devotee of God. He sees the presence of God in everyone and in everything, and he sees everything in God. So, such a person is called a Brahmana. Now, if you take this definition, which is the definition given by Lord Krishna himself in the Bhagavad Gita, which of course, unfortunately, it is not a name of a birth or a caste. I should say a few things about how this is misunderstood. Well, I won't go too far, but during interaction I can enlighten you more. You see, in course of time what happened in India, it's an ancient country, highly disorganized. It's why each group has its own way of spiritual practices, because there is so much of freedom. But behind all that, there is the idea that God is all-pervading everywhere. And it is one attributeless reality. So, what happened? These great ideas that you find in the Vedas and the Bhagavad Gita, and also in the Buddha's teachings, which I'm going to quote right now, were totally hijacked by the priestcraft, and also by the ruling classes. Just as, for example, you know, when I don't want to go too far, but you know, if you read the important works that led to the collapse of Soviet Union, you find there were special privileges for the members of the party. The British, they have their own schools, where their own children can alone go for education. Their own supermarkets, where the members of the Pradesium alone can go for shopping. Their own universities and colleges, where common people are not allowed. A much more conservative and privileged system than what existed during the Romanov dynasty, the Tsars, Nicholas II, who was the last emperor of the Romanov dynasty. So this kind of hijacking of ancient spiritual ideas do happen in the history of world civilizations. So look at what Buddha says. It's something very interesting and very striking, you know. And Buddha was a very enlightened person who took all the great ideas of Hindu Vedantic tradition and put in a very informal language, in the language called Pali, which is the common language. It's not as refined as Sanskrit. He spoke in Prakrit, and his teachings were recorded in Pali canonical literature. So you find here, Diva Tapadi Adichu, Rittima Abhadi Chantima. It is similar to Sanskrit, but it is still very different. It's a corrupted form of Sanskrit. Sannadho Kattiyo Tapati Kshatriya becomes Khatiya. You know, it is Pali. You find a difference. Nyayi tapati brahmano atha sampamahorattam buddho tapati tejasa. What it means is, the sun shines by day. By night, the moon shines. The resplendent in his armor, that is, the appears a warrior. A warrior appears effulgent in his armor. Lustrous in meditation, a Brahmin. He is meditating on the all-pervading reality. So he is called a Brahmin. So you can imagine. Now, this is the great teachings of this 46th verse of the second chapter. That means a person who is above differences, above the secular spiritual equation, differentiation, who can see the spiritual even in the secular, who can think of the all-pervading reality of the presence of God, even when he's not inside a temple or a church or a place of worship, who can see the spiritual in the secular. Just as when there is a flood, you don't go to a river to take bath, you don't go to a well to drink water, you bathe, you drink water, you may swim in the same flood waters. I mean, all lines of demarcations completely vanish. This is the central ideal of the Brahmin, this is the high universal spiritual ideal that everyone should strive for. You find such people, such great men and women in all traditions, maybe Christ was a Brahmana by this definition, so also Buddha, who was actually born in the warrior caste. So it is this universality of spiritual outlook that makes a person a Brahmin. That's why, you know, sarvada sampludodagi tavan sarveshu vedeshu brahmanasya vijanataha. In the Vedas, in these ancient scriptures, there are many teachings which are not necessarily spiritual, which constitute prayers for secular enjoyments, but a person who understands the Vedantic message of the universality of the divine reality present everywhere, for him there is no differentiation. And not only that, tarvan sarveshu vedeshu. There is another very important message which I would like to discuss in the light of a very celebrated commentator. You know, it was Shankaracharya who lived in 8th century AD, who actually brought out the teachings of Bhagavad Gita for the benefit of all of us. If he had not written his commentary, we won't be reading Bhagavad Gita today. And along with, in the midst of his innumerable great works, Vivekananda, the founder of this organization of which Vedanta Society is a branch, considers this commentary on the Bhagavad Gita as one of the greatest works of this great philosopher, Saint Shankaracharya. I shall just read and I shall try to explain. It's very interesting. Yatha loge koopa tadaga adi anekasmin udapani parichinnodage yavan yavat parimanaha snanapanadihi artha phalam prayojanam sa sarvaha arthaha sarvadasvampludodage tavan eva sampadyade tatra antarbhavaditi arthaha evam tavan tavat parimana eva sampadyade sarveshu vedeshu vedokteshu karma suyap artho yat karma phalam sa arthaha brahmanasya sanyasinaha paramarthatattvam vijanataha ya artho vijnana phalam sarvadasvampludodaka sthaniyam tasmin tavan eva sampadyade tatra eva antarbhavati ityarthaha. I am quoting from ancient work, maybe a little too fast, but I shall try to explain. Even if you don't understand one word of it, you won't miss anything. The implication is this. As the illustration continues, you know, we use water from the well. That's what he says. It is from Shankaracharya alone we get this meaning. The 46th verse of the second chapter. So the great commentator says, for different purposes, like bathing, drinking water, maybe swimming, we use different sources of water, river, well, ponds, and so on. So there is a differentiation. Like that, at the beginning of a spiritual life, we may perhaps, divide our 24 hours of the day for different purposes. Well, 2 hours in the morning, maybe 1 hour at least, we may read holy scriptures, we may pray to God, we may meditate, we may do certain activities which we consider to be the most essential spiritual practices we do. And evening also we may do. Or maybe Sundays we may go to church. Or another day we may go to synagogue or place of worship, Buddhism, whatever it is. This is how we start our spiritual life. But the great commentator says, this is wonderful, very good, but it's only primary school. You can't reach the university without first going through primary school. You can't straight away go. If you're a small kid, you can't straight away go to the university. So this is necessary. But then, the ultimate goal should be that when we reach a higher stage of spiritual evolution, education continues throughout your life. If a person believes that he has exhausted his educational activities when he leaves the university, his education will not be complete. It will remain incomplete. So real education is something that we continue throughout our life as long as we live, so long as we learn. That is, the great Sri Ramakrishna himself made the statement, the teacher of Swami Vivekananda. Well, like that, a spiritually enlightened person, when he reaches a higher level of spiritual evolution, for him, there is no such thing as a secular activity. Even the so-called secular activity is also spiritual activity. So for him, there is no need to set apart a fixed time for spiritual practices. Now in the Vedas, there are many prayers, many rituals also mentioned, not only philosophy, it's a huge body of scripture, very huge. The highest Vedanta philosophy that we are discussing, that is the essence of the Vedic literature. But there are also many aspects related to everyday secular life practices and so on. And there are many prayers and practices meant for attaining material enjoyments. The commentator says, a spiritually enlightened person will enjoy a special kind of bliss when he reaches this higher level of spiritual evolution. When he feels the presence of God, not only inside a temple or a church or a place of worship, not only for 1 hour in the morning and 1 hour in the evening, but throughout 24 hours of the day, because whatever he does is an offering to God. Every activity becomes a spiritual activity. Every thought becomes a meditation. Every word becomes a sacred prayer. Whole life gets spiritualized. That's why the commentator says, when you get this highest knowledge, then you won't look for any other source for enjoyment. The greatest enjoyment is spiritual enjoyment. Because that gives you a mind which can look for this higher inner blissfulness, even in the midst of the ordinary secular activities. So in the Upanishad, you call Ananda Mimamsa. The ascending order of enjoyment, it is not enjoyment, ascending order of bliss. The highest bliss is spiritual blissfulness. That is the view of the Vedantic scriptures. So, that's why in the Vedantic tradition, I mentioned last time, there are three main schools of Vedanta proper. One is the celebrated school that we all follow, the non-dualistic school called Advaita. So today if you go to India, if you go to the Himalayas, if you go to spiritual centers, sometimes you find, including many of the great IT geniuses of America, have been wandering all over India, visiting the spiritual places. You know what they were looking for? They were looking for these teachings of Advaita. They were looking for these Advaitic teachings. A man like Paul Brunton suddenly felt an impulse to go to India and meet Ramana Maharshi, and what he learned, what fascinated him, was this great teaching of Advaita. Shankaracharya, who actually brought out the great teachings of Bhagavad Gita, for the good of all of us. The second in importance is called Vishishtadvaita. It means a qualified non-dualistic system, which is a school of philosophy within Vedanta, Vedantic framework, which emerged around 11th century AD. So Shankara lived in 8th century. Ramanuja, who is the exponent of this Vishishtadvaita, non-qualified system, which is a kind of partial Advaita. Partially, it is non-dualistic. It emerged in the 11th century. And in Madhva, who is just the opposite of Advaita, is dualistic system. So I can just for academic interest, I can quote a few of their quotations from, just for interest. He says, for example, Shankaracharya says, Brahmanasya, Brahman is sannyasi. Sannyasi is a man of renunciation of selfishness and ego. That is how Shankaracharya defines a Brahmana. And then Madhvacharya, the dualist philosopher, says, you know, he says, Yadeva moksha sadhanam tavadu buddhayam nanyat. And Ramanuja says, Brahma anati iti brahmanaha aparoksha jnani. That is Madhvacharya says. The one who has an awareness of this transcendental spiritual unity and oneness of existence. That's it. Then Ramanuja says, Brahmanasya vijanataka vaidigasya mumukshoho. A spiritual seeker, an ardent spiritual seeker, is naturally can be called a Brahmin in the universal sense. Now, one question arises here. No. Frequently, this is a very high ideal. How do we reach that ideal? Or how do we practice that ideal? I mentioned this, you know. Very often you find a conflict between what we actually want to do and what we actually end up doing in our real life. We listen to a great lecture, we read a great book, we suddenly we are inspired by a great teaching, by a great ideal. And we do understand its relevance, its importance, and also its practical benefit. For if you can look upon these worldly phenomena, which brings you happiness today and happiness tomorrow, which creates all the anxieties and problems and worries. If you can look at this worldly phenomenon from a higher perspective, then we can live in this world, work hard, succeed in our worldly ambitions, because if you are working for a job, you are a businessman, a professor, whatever, maybe you have to succeed. That's part of our existence. Now, how do we, in what way are we benefited by this great ideal that we discussed earlier, but the discussion continues. A person who has reached this ideal is called Siddha Prajna. And that's the discussion, that's going to be the topic for discussion from 55th to 72nd verse of this chapter. And we have only reached 46th and 47th. So within maybe 1 or 2 weeks, we will continue. And then we will begin a long discussion of the characteristics of a spiritually enlightened person and how to reach there and how to bring a little bit of that higher ideal into our own life and make practical use of it in our own workplace, whatever may be a profession. Now, in this, when you deal with this question, one topic that frequently attracts our attention is this conflict. What we want to do because we are inspired by a great teaching and the obstacles that we have to encounter, mind won't permit us to do. Why is it that our own mind doesn't cooperate when we sincerely try to do something that we want to do, which we know is going to be beneficial? Maybe two sessions earlier, I referred to Dostoevsky's theory. You know, frequently there is a degenerate natural passion for something which is self-destructive, which Dostoevsky discusses in Brothers Karamazov. I'm leaving that aside, but there's a very, that's kind of aberration in a natural tendency you'll find among certain people. They know this is something they should not do, but they have hell-bent on doing that. But that's very, very rare. Normally, all of us, all normal people belong to another category. They want to do sincerely, and they are trying to do, but very often they do not succeed. Their own mind, their own accumulated tendencies, habits, and emotions create an insurmountable mental block. So how do we confront it? So this is called a conflict between what we want to do and what our mind actually permits us to do. Now, how to make our mind cooperate more closely with what we want to do? How to reduce the obstacles? So one method which is recommended in Vedantic tradition is, if you go on with your struggles or efforts, that efforts itself will produce a peculiar kind of positive mental tendency, a huge reservoir of positive tendencies, even a sincere desire for doing something good will have a positive effect on the mental system. That's the difference between the mental and the physical. If you want to help a person, well, he's a poor man, I would like to give him $10, $20, something. You may not have the money with you, but you have the sincere desire to help somebody. That does something good for your mind, though he doesn't get anything, unfortunately. But the physical activity, you have to do it, then only the man is benefited. You want to give $20 to a person, or maybe you want to draw a check for $1,000 for helping the earthquake victims of far-off countries. You have a sincere desire. That desire, that flash of idea in your mind will produce a mental tendency. It's called samskara in yoga and Vedanta. Samskara or vasana, a vritti. So even a desire, even an effort to do something good will not be totally devoid of its actual benefit. So at least for us, so every sincere thought, every sincere effort, every sincere idea, noble thought, will produce a positive, a spiritually healthy and helpful tendency in the mental system. Once we continue that, our mental block, which are actually nothing but a series of tendencies, will slowly become more and more friendly with us, and mind will start cooperating with us more closely. That's why Shankaracharya says in one of the important statements, he says, the list of a spiritually enlightened person is given not for your information, not for your theoretical information, only because you should try to get those characteristics for you, because once you get those characteristics, one day you will end up being a spiritually enlightened person. The spiritually enlightened person's characteristics are methods and means for one to develop. We should strive to develop those good qualities. Wisdom, equanimity of mind, the ability to look at good and bad, pain and pleasure, profit and loss, happiness and unhappiness, with an equanimity of mind, with the perfect equilibrium of mind, but without being negligent or indifferent towards duties, doing our best to succeed in everything, still we should be able to look at success and failure with the same equanimity of mind. So this is one of the characteristics of a spiritually enlightened person. You find in the coming verses. This is something which everyone can strive to internalize and develop for himself. So now we'll go to the next verse, which we already discussed a little, and after that we'll go to the next one. Karmanneva adhigaraste ma phaleshu kadachana ma karma phalahe durbhuhu ma te sangostu akarmani. I already discussed this. Actually, it's a fact that we have control over only on our own effort. The exact result of our activities is not 100% within our control. When we operate a machine, how it's going to function is within our control. But how our own mind is going to function is not within our control. So we cannot control our mind the way we control a machine. So that's why identical activities and experiments will produce identical results in science. But in life, it doesn't happen that way. You go on working hard, put your best effort, and you succeed, and you will think that when I get plenty of money, lot of wealth, I will be very happy, but it doesn't happen. Very rarely it happens. So, the means do not always constitute the totality of the ends in real life. You go on helping a person with all noble intentions. That person may turn out to be your worst enemy. So, in Sri Ramakrishna's gospel, there's an interesting thing. Somebody came to Isharajandi Vidyasagar, who was a philanthropist, and told him, well, this person is criticizing you unnecessarily. Then he said, I did not do anything to help him. Then why should he criticize me? I did not do anything. I did not try to help him in any way. So why should he criticize me? So you help a person, then you will be criticized. Now, this doesn't happen in physics or mathematics. 2 + 2 is always 4 in mathematics. 2 + 2 is not always the same in life. 2 + 2 can be anything in life. Not necessarily 4. But 2 + 2 is always 4 in physics and mathematics. That means the predictability, the ability to anticipate a definite result is not 100% in real life as it is in mathematics. What does it mean? That's what Lord Krishna says, karmani eva te adhikaraka. Adhikaraka actually means not right. It means your role stops with what you do. The result will be produced according to your activity, but that result is not 100% predictable. It is not within your control. That's why if you go on helping a person, if you apply mathematical logic, that person should help you back, reciprocate. At least you should not become your born enemy. That's what Girishandra Ghosh says, I did not help him any time, then why should he criticize me? So question. That means in life, the logic of mathematics does not apply. So, that's why Lord Krishna says, in reality, from a purely psychological perspective, your right is only for doing your best as an offering to God, if you believe in God, or as a part of your own duty and responsibility. If you are an agnostic, anyone can practice the spiritual psychology of Bhagavad Gita. Bhagavad Gita is so fascinating, so universal. It doesn't talk about going to temple and pray. It doesn't talk about any particular religion. It talks about the universal spiritual doctrines. It talks about the evolution of human spiritual life, human spiritual pursuit. So that's why it says, your right stops with your effort. The results are not always predictable. Then the next 2-3 verses are very important because they further discuss this karma yoga ideal. This is an important definition of the psychology of karma yoga. You find yogastha kuru karmani sangam tyaktva dhananjaya siddhya siddhyo samabhutva samattam yoga uchyate. According to Gandhi's writings, some of these verses actually guided him all through his life. So this is some of these verses. Karma yoga is more elaborately discussed in the third chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. But the psychology of karma yoga is put in a nutshell in this particular verse, the 48th verse of the second chapter. Yogastha kuru karmani means do your work. Here, karma doesn't necessarily mean physical activity. As frequently it is translated in dictionaries. Kridhatu indicates any kind of movement, any activity involving energy. That is the dhatu. Kru means the root, Sanskrit root. Krukarane. So, even a thought is an activity. When an idea flashes in your mind, that's an activity, mental activity. When you think of something, it's an activity. When you speak, it's an activity. So, there is no such thing which is not an activity. So, Lord Krishna says, do your work, be engaged in whatever activity you are going to be engaged. But one important condition, yogasthaha. Yoga, yogesthitaha means be established in yoga. So what is yoga here? Yoga here means connecting ourselves with something transcendental. That is yoga. So you samadho and you yogi. There are two meanings. There are many other meanings, but two fundamental meanings for the root yuj, which is the root of the Sanskrit root of word yoga, is one is samadhi, the other is connecting with the transcendental. See, if we can connect our activity, whether verbal activity like speaking a word, or intellectual activity like thinking a thought, whatever may be, if we can link it to something universal and transcendental, then every act becomes a step towards spiritual enlightenment. If it is not linked to the transcendental spiritual ideal, then every act becomes a chain that binds you to this world. So how does it become a chain on the one hand, and how does it become a means to raise beyond the empirical, to connect with the transcendental? So I should try to explain. Normally, whatever we do, action, word, deed, thought, anything, will leave a residual effect on our mental system. You cannot do any conscious activity, a thought or word or deed or anything, without that activity leaving a residual effect in your mental system. That residual effect is called vritti in yoga and also in Vedanta. So a series of activities which are done consciously will become a strong tendency, an attitude, a behavior pattern, which is called a samskara, and that will prompt you to continue that activity or to avoid that activity. If the result of what we do is pleasant, then we will have a tendency to continue that activity. If the result is not pleasant, then we may have a tendency to avoid that activity. Now, once we do our duty and work without any selfish motive, by linking it to some higher transcendental ideal, then this vritti the residual effect is totally gone. It doesn't produce any residual effect. It doesn't produce any vritti. Any action, if you do, with a higher ideal, linking that action to some transcendental spiritual ideal, it doesn't produce in your mind this heavy burden of a samskara, an impression or anything. Well, I can give you examples. The great spiritual teachers, I give these examples many times. Maybe the most wonderful example that I can give is the Swami who built this very temple. His name was Swami Trinadidananda. He was one of the disciples of Sri Ramakrishna. You know, before he came to San Francisco, he was wandering the Himalayas. I'm talking about people who lived in our own times, more or less, close to our times. There are many other examples. If I can give Shankaracharya's example, I can give Abraham Lincoln's example, I can give many, but I'm giving just something that you can very easily identify with. So this Swami was wandering the Himalayas, like with a long beard. You can see his picture. He's certainly not the kind of dress code for San Francisco City even in 1900. But Vivekananda asked him to come to this city, and he reached here in 1903 January. And you can see his picture now. This was not his picture. This is not the dress in which he wandered all over the Himalayas. Some kind of rags with a long beard. You can see his picture in some of other photos. So when he came here, he underwent a complete transformation. And within 13 years, he built this temple within less than 5 months, which we took almost 3.5 years in the 21st century with all modern technology. And then he established a convent, a printing press, a monastic tradition, and he reorganized and rebuilt the Vedanta society all within less than, he passed away in 1915, within less than 13 years. You may imagine, if you read his life, you find, we don't know if at all he ever slept. So how could they do so much? I'm talking just imagine the physical energy. After all, you'll be tired after all. And you know, when do we get tired? When we do a lot of work, and then we sit, oh, I did a lot of work. At that moment, we get tired, really speaking. Suppose when you're working hard, and you don't feel you're working, you don't feel that much tired. You may do little, and then sit, well, I did one great job, then you become tired. So, that is said about, a more unlikely person like Gandhi was a saintly politician. He said about him also. So how do they do so much without feeling fatigued, tired and exhausted? Because whatever they do with a degree of detachment. Detachment means non-attachment. Not being obsessed with their own selfish desires, goals and ambitions. With total unselfishness. When they do, they can do so much. You ask them, well, I didn't do anything. It all happened by the grace of my guru. That's what he said. Now, this is pure psychology, spiritual psychology. That's the meaning of the word yogastha. So yogastha guru karmani sangam tektva dhananjaya siddhya siddhyo samo bhutva. So when you are establishing yoga, you won't be obsessed with the result. If your work produces its expected result, or more beyond limit, you won't be overjoyed. And if it falls short of your expectations, you won't be disappointed. So mind remains fresh, happy and vigorous. And you do great things. That's a very wonderful aspect of the spiritual psychology enshrined in this 48 verse. We'll continue the discussion in the next class. Now we can have interaction for some time. Okay, thank you. then we will, there is no question. And we are happy actually there is no question. It's also perfectly clear.
Good evening, Swamiji. You mentioned this idea with karma yoga of any kind of movement, like thought or speech or action. You said any sort of movement, like of energy. Wherever there's energy, is there consciousness and vice versa?
Yeah, without consciousness, there can be no energy. Energy is a manifestation of consciousness at the level of rajoguna. You know, it's a rajasic manifestation of energy. Yeah. Inactivity is a tamasic manifestation. So thank you. We will continue the discussion in the next session. Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi Harihi Om Tat Sat Sri Ramakrishna Arpanamastu.